So for quite a while, boy, especially they came out, I think it's at 1.3. It's nothing but problems for a long time.
Okay. I wasn't aware of too many problems with the 1.3. I know about, I think, 6 months or a year after I got the 1.3 was when the manufacturer of the power transistors simply stopped making them. So they started to actually put 1.5 kilowatt power modules in the final of the 1.3 without charging anything extra, because they were going to get rid of the model very, very soon after. And you know, they were really promoting the 1.5. I run mine mostly in low power at 500 watts. I haven't really found the need to pump it out at 1.3. Maybe that's why I have no problems with it. I don't know. But, Italians, I hate to kind of make generalizations, but they sort of have a reputation that they make beautiful things, but they're sort of shoddy on the inside. Again, I've personally not had any problems with mine once I finally got it. My lovely software-defined radio, my Flex Radio, is 6700. I love it, but I had to replace it for three different units through its life for sundry reasons. The replacement and repair policy is very nice with Flex Radio, but thankfully I haven't had anything like that happen to me with my linear.
Yeah, again, once again, you jog my memory. Yeah, I think you're right. It was originally the 1.3, and then they came out with the 1.5. And the 1.5 was where the problems really kicked in. There were always problems with the 1.3, it was okay. But when they went to that 1.5, they really problems. Again, this is just from one of them, and it seems as of late has gotten better. I think when you put your 1.3, when I put my 2KFA, that was, they weren't made to the 1.5, they were 1.3. So we're both probably 4 hours in around the same ballpark. I probably had when I put my, about 6-7 years ago. So, like I said, I think we might have ordered, at the very time to buy that piece of equipment, which I'm glad.
UGS. Well, sometimes you got to be lucky because other times we're not. So at least I was lucky with my linear amplifier. Thankfully the distributor fixes it in the United States. It used to be a guy, the first two guys, I think were located in and around Texas. I don't remember I think the new distributor is the guy who bought up the bug Morse code keys as well. He's slowly kind of building a business. I don't know where he's located. I haven't looked him up yet because I thankfully haven't needed him. So, I don't know. It's a very nice linear amplifier. I get a lot of good use out of it. I would recommend it to other people, except that they don't sell the 1.3 anymore. You got to factor in forums for the fact that guys who are happy with their stuff don't spend that much time saying nice things about their stuff. They just use their stuff quietly, and that's it. The ones that got lemons and junkers, they're the ones who are complaining at the top of their voice.
Oh, yeah. Totally agree. How was... Just let me back up here for a minute. I know there was a big problem with the STD spike, an initial spike when you key down, not the usual certain ham radio models. I think one of them was I have the 950. I never had a problem. And some other ones, 10-wood and this and that, when you initially click down on the mic, there's a spike, and that was burning out something. The guys were coming up with gadgets to get around. But what I was I believe Rick, there was some difficulties getting the SPE to key up with the Flex radios. Was there any, did you encounter anything like that?
KC2GS, no. There's a gentleman, I'm sure you bought his product. He makes cables. Control cables that interface with the Expert Systems linear amplifier. I got a cable from him. I plugged it in. I tweaked and adjusted the things so that they were, you know, when it sensed that I had set it to copper, it dropped the drive levels of my flex radio to the right levels. It's been working since.
Yeah, again, you jogged my memory. I believe that gentleman's name was Dan, if memory serves me. And a real gentleman. He helped me more with, you know, just problems getting up and running than the guy I bought it from. The gentleman I got it from was very old and very cranky. And Dan was very, I didn't even really have that many questions. One or two certain things popped up with the gene temperature. It was just okay. You know, just a normal, quick, easy question. But he's very knowledgeable. I heard on Foreman said he's no longer making those cables. We don't regret. No, I should have rigged that. I got to find out. Make one myself. It's one of those things I think that it's really not that hard, but it's just something else to learn.
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, if you have a lot of energy and want to be able to tell people that you did it all yourself, it's doable. But it's you know, it's a little bit of a nuisance. He's a good guy. Cable's kind of expensive. You probably were talking to the first distributor. There were, like I said, there have been three. The first distributor was a cranky old guy. The second distributor, who used to be his repair guy, and when he got sick and passed away, his daughter, who was not a ham, and his grandson, who was, I think, about 18 years old, thought that they were going to take over the business, and they didn't have the faintest idea what they were doing. So that didn't last very long, so the repair guy got the distributorship. And one time we were sitting around on the phone talking, and he was giving me these little bits and pieces of stories of the first distributor would go to Xenon or whatever Hamfest was, and tell kind of questionable stories about Italian distributors and such, and it was apparently designed by Israelis, and he was telling some kind of vaguely anti-Semitic stories too. So he was a bit of a cranky old guy indeed.
Yeah, you know, he, I mean, this guy was, well, yeah, he was a much, like I said, just, there was something, you know, in the manual about, something about the temperature, and I thought, I just shot him an email, and he wouldn't even answer it. I caught him on one day, we had a nice conversation, then after that, he was just a total crank, oh my God, and you know, you're buying a, God, I think I spent like $5,000 on that thing, and, very careful not to make a nuisance of my own or ask too many questions, but just the basics even. That being said, I do know with the technical stuff, he was really good at that. He would repair them too. He had a repair guy, but he would get into repair. So I got to take my hat off to him. He knew his stuff. But I think it was one of these things. He was just too old, you know, when all of us. I got many friends, but very good friends. Boy, are they crying now, you know, they're getting up there, and man, oh man. So, yep, that's got to be the same guy we're talking about.
Yeah, the good times, what can I say? I mean, it was nice conversation. Great product, like I said, I personally have not had any problems with it. I've had problems with my PAL Star tuners, I've had problems with my Flex 6700, knock on wood, no problems with the linear amplifier. So, what can I tell you, John? It's, you get a lot of interesting stuff out of this hobby.
Oh, yeah, and without a doubt. And just look at this year, you know, we're in a different commission. You know, we both find out we have the same linear, not the same linear, but from the same company. And, or acquainted with some of the same people. So, yep, that's all of it, that's for sure.
Yes, indeed. It's a small, small world.
I'll turn it back to Ned, Hoyle South here, and thanks again, boys. We're always up in November 2, Zoom and Charlie.
Likewise. There was someone who doubled. Do you want to repeat what you said?
Chet, WB2L Hotel Kilo.
Yes, Chet, what can I do?
Hi, this is in reference to MFJ. I heard the show, we're bound for the last week or so. Mary is listening on the ham bands. According to one group, people who seem to know, MFJ is going to be closing down on May 17th for good. And they're going to, he's going to try to give severance pay to all his employees. And he's going to try to keep the repair department going for warranty. But one interesting thing of ramification, remember a couple of months ago when QST or ARL said they wanted to raise the prices of the subscription to the Kitty magazine? You remember that? And I had a subscription with them. I was still running 3 months into this year, and I obviously stopped coming when they cut me off at the end of the year. I was a little angry at them, and I decided not to renew after 30, 40 years. But an interesting thing is, if you notice looking, if anybody gets it, the magazine, it's getting more and more and more smaller. There's mostly advertisements in there. And then they started sticking in stories from year ago, putting it in, they call it fillers, into the magazine. And if most people look at it very carefully, you will see MFJ was the one who was the biggest advertiser to the QST magazine. And with them dropping out, that's going to cause the demise of most likely the magazine itself completely because of lack of income coming in. So that's a ramification that is staring one in the face. Go ahead.
Yeah, Chet. They've been stuffing it with archive material for at least 3 years, maybe more. What they used to do is they stuffed it with content results. And they did surveys and found out that most people really didn't care about the contest results, only the people in the contest. So I think that's why they shifted. Editorial content is always thin at these types of magazines. Q Magazine is a first example. They've done archival reprints. They've missed issues. They've missed multiple issues. Even Nuts and Bolts. I get Nuts and Bolts. I really like magazines, and I'm happy that they're kind of going out of business, almost all of them. And Nuts and Bolts just sent me their latest issue, which is dated the fifth issue of 2022. They've decided that when they miss publishing dates, they don't just skip the issue. They just backdate the new issues and such. So that's kind of, unfortunately, the future of most magazines. Most advertising has moved away to the Internet, and most reading has moved away to the Internet. So there's little demand, there's little payment, and there's little profit. And so all of these companies are kind of stinking, except for the really massive, big-time ones. I think with QST, they will survive longer than most of the other magazines because they're not solely a subscription-slash-advertisement device. That's not where they get 100% of their money. They get it from guys like me who are willing to pay extra in subscription fees and membership dues and such. So when there are more people not like me than like me and they're not paying in to the publication cost, then I guess what will happen is what almost always happens. They will shift to a website version for about an hour and a half, and then you will never see them again.
That's it. Okay. Good night. I'll be listening. WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilo.
Okay. Very good, Chetty. Yes, Jim.
Roy and Ed. Interesting concept topic about MFJ. I'm a little not understanding that. Nobody's a little worried that the premier, if I'm missing the point, tell me so, problem solver in communicating amongst American citizens suddenly decided to throw his whole company and group of companies into the dumpster. Nobody questions that might be there's some nefarious in the works. Sounds fishy to me, and I'll leave it at that. Back to that.
Okay. I mean, the reality is most people know Martin Jew. He's a bit of a personality among amateur radio operators. He's shown up on a bunch of different podcasts. He looks to be, in his late 70s. He's kind of skinny, kind of frail looking, but apparently able to keep the business going. And I don't know. I mean, in the 12 years I've been a ham, I've regularly seen other companies simply go out of business. A lot of companies are run by a relatively small number of people, and when they retire or old or get sick or die, they try to sell the property. Sometimes they sell it off to MFJ. Sometimes they sell it off to someone else, but just as often, just kind of fade away. So this is nothing new in the amateur radio business, unfortunately. This is a kind of geriatric hobby, and most of the people don't really, I think, do it for the profit. They do it for the joy, and those people tend to be elderly now. So I don't know. I don't think this is nefarious. I think this is just a very elderly gentleman who tried to find a guy who would be willing to take up probably a somewhat expensive enterprise and couldn't find anyone. He breaks it up into little pieces. He might find enough people to kind of, have a bunch of small companies left behind. But I don't know of anyone in this business who has the balls to kind of gather up all of MFJ and take it on for themselves. That's a big responsibility.
No doubt. My point. Thank you for listening to my point, but I'm suspicious of the whole situation. Thank you, Roy. Thank you.
Okay, you're free to be suspicious of it. Again, it sort of makes sense to me. It doesn't surprise me. To me, it was kind of in the back of my head a question of when. Martin was kind of the only guy who would just kind of gobble up company. Most of the time, you were lucky if some guy just took a small size company by itself rather than just kind of build it into a massive organization like Martin did. So I think he was very unusual in the amateur radio entrepreneurial lesson. And I can't imagine anyone who could take his place at this time. So, again, not incredibly surprising. It's unfortunate, but that's the nature of things. Things are born, they grow, and then they pass away. Anyway, anyone with any comments before we go to something else?
Yeah, I always thought MFJ was overpriced, especially in the later years.
Well, it depends upon how you look at it. Their stuff at times were somewhat slipshod. Primarily, I think the reason for the severe quality issues was for a period of time they were getting their labor from the local prisons, which I don't think is the most motivated workers you can find, but after a while, he kind of self-corrected, and he stopped doing that, and he hired college kids and other people. The bottom line was always, he wasn't going to pay a premium for anyone. So he just found a somewhat better group of people to assemble his things. I used to joke that whenever I bought an MFJ product, I always would kind of shake it, listen for a rattle, and even if I didn't hear one, I'd unscrew the top and take a good look around and make sure there wasn't anything loose going around there or cold solder joints or something like that. They simply had a incredibly large list of products. You know, almost anything amateur radio related, not necessarily the cheapest, but you know, in one place you could find almost anything you needed. Not the best quality, not the cheapest, but you know, still something there. So I think he'll be missed in the hobby.
The BB2BXO.
Yes, Frank.
Yeah, whatever it's worth, Amateur Radio Newsline said to Martin Jew, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but at any rate, Martin is 80 years old, and I did not know that's why their quality was so poor. That is an interesting story if it's true. I don't know, if you have a moment, I'll tell you a story I heard on the air about them a number of years ago. Go ahead.
Sure, please.
Yeah, back in the 80s, I think it was the 80s or early 90s, there was an expatriate in Belize, I forget what call sign was, or V31, something or other, who ran in the MFJ JunkNet on 10 meters. And I guess Martin's sales vice president used to call the guy and beg him to stop. Eventually, the poor guy in Belize decided to repair his MFJ here, opening up while the power was still on. And I think I need to tell you what happened to the poor guy.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, if he was in Japan, it would probably be term seppuku. So, that's a shame. That's a terrible way to go. I mean, thankfully, most of our equipment is 12 volts now. Even my expert systems, I believe, run around 50 or 55 volts. There's no real high voltage potentials going on anywhere in my boxes, but you still have to be careful.
Yeah, there are lots of terrible stories about how concerned it was about these issues. But I do remember hearing the MFJ JunkNet on 10 meters run by this fella. It was probably around 1990. It had to have been near the Sun Peak when you could do a net like that and get people calling calling in from all over the world with their MFJ horror stories. Good.
Yeah, that's why they were all mighty fine junk, MFJ. I've never heard of a company that, I've never come across a company, I should say, that was so consistently panned quality-wise than MFJ in any industry.
Martin can't sell them.
Yeah, we kind of tripled there. Mighty Fine Junk. We've all kind of told the joke to each other. Well, they did have a significant quality control issue. I was told that one of the reasons was the prison labor. You know, I forget if it's Mississippi or Alabama where he's located, but that was the story that I got, and that they switched to college kids. Other low price workers that were a little bit more diligent. But, you know, it's kind of obviously true because, you know, this is not just a joke. We've all kind of experienced the weirdness of MFJ products. They weren't quite all what they were supposed to be when we got them. So, you know, but, you know, I mean, he kind of understood and he made allowances that, you know, if they were the only ones that had a grid dip meter and you wanted a grid dip meter, then you got a kind of shoddy grid dip meter, but at least it was a grid dip meter, as otherwise you'd have to sit around on eBay for a couple of weeks trying to figure out how to get one that isn't broken. So, yeah, you know, it was what it was. You know, it's the end of an era, like most things in the hobby.
I just went on the website. I don't see it mentioned anywhere that they're closing.
Well, I don't know. I kind of Googled it, and I saw it, and I think it's legit. Sometimes, you know, the guy who runs their website is the most current person on the staff. So I guess he's putting that aside as one of the last things to do. You know, as I understand, and other people have mentioned, they will be repairing units. They'll be selling off units that they've already manufactured, but they're just not going to be manufacturing any new units from this point on. So, you know, it's sort of like what happened with Radio Shack, where they had a big inventory. They seemed to be selling stuff for years afterwards, even though they were sort of out of business. So it'll probably be something like that.
You would think that they would warn ham radio operators that they're going out of business if it's been a little over 2 weeks. But the website, and I disagree with you, Roy, I think their website person is the most up-to-date person, not the least up-to-date person. And in any way, I've had a problem with MFJ and the stuff I've bought and all the stories I heard over the years. So, yeah, they were the ones who had the product, but they had a cheap product at an overpriced point. So, I don't feel sorry for them.
Okay. You're free to have grudges. Let me just read you. Apparently, Martin Yu sent emails to people April 25th. I'll read it to you because it's not that long. It says, "Dear fellow hams and friends, it is with a sad heart as I write this letter. As many of you have heard by now, MFJ is ceasing its on-site production in Starkville, Mississippi on May 17th, 2024. This is also the same for our sister companies, Amatron, High Gain, Cushcraft, Mirage, and Vectronics. Times have changed since I started this business 52 years ago. Our product line grew and grew, prospered. COVID changed everything in business, including ours. It was the hardest hit that we have ever had, and we never fully recovered. I turned 80 this year, never really considered retirement, but life is so short and my time with my family is so precious. I want to thank all of our employees who have helped to build this company with me over the years. We have many employees who have made MFJ their career for 10, 20, 30, 40, and more years. We are going to continue to sell MFJ products past May 17, 2024. We have a lot of stock on hand. We will continue to offer repair services out of warranty and in warranty units for the foreseeable future. Finally, a special thank you to all our customers and our dealers who have made MFG a worldwide name and a profitable business for so many years. You all are so much appreciated. Sincerely yours, 73's, Martin J. FU K5 FLU.
What would COVID have to do with ham radio equipment?
Well, unfortunately, I think it probably killed a lot of active elderly hams. I know of at least two or three who passed away due to complications. You know, dead customers don't really buy too much. Yes, John?
Yeah, you know what, too, I'm thinking, just because, you know, supply chain. The supply chain, not getting parts. People, you know, shut down. I don't know if his factory was, you know, forcibly shut down or whatever. I could very easily see that COVID, you know, wrecked so many different businesses. But that's just my two cents. I have no reason to doubt him on that. But, you know, I don't know. It's just yes.
Yeah, that's possible. Though most of his products don't use ultra high-end imported parts that were kind of in short supply. You know, like solid-state electronics and such. And I would assume that places like Mississippi did not have a big social distancing program that shut down businesses. So I'm not quite sure whether it was the pull or the push, you know, whether it was customers dying or no longer being, you know, active hams, and how much of it was problems getting supplies. I don't recall looking through the catalog, seeing a lot of available subs, but, you know, I never really investigated it that much.
Yeah, neither did I. I do know, though, sometimes, strangely enough, there was like HRO, and many times the MSJ products not in stock. Now, one thing I'll say for them, they sold a lot of cool little matches. Now, I'm not going to get into quality. I'm not going to talk about the quality, but which is really a shame, because I bought a few of their things. I forgot the name of it. They're one little cool device where it has a rope map and a mic's going off all around it. You know, it's just cool stuff that everybody does in a century. I did see a lot of times, always out of stock with MSJ stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't really investigate it that much. And, yeah, they made a lot of cheap tchotchkes. They had clocks, which basically were those $5 Chinese digital coin battery-operated LCD gray background. You know, they probably were manufactured in the 90s or so. They would kind of put on a base someplace, make it look a little bit more special. But, yeah, they had a lot of cheap tchotchkes. They had a lot of stuff that you would not be surprised to find in a amateur radio operator's shack from 1950. But at that point, they were the only people actually manufacturing those little things like grid dip meters and such.
Yeah, they did a great job, whether intentionally or not, in packaging it. And I hate to admit it, because I'm really not that type of person, but I go for it with the antenna analyzer. I bought the MFJ-259, and thank God, it served me well. But, from the reviews and everything, I probably shouldn't have. But their equipment just looks like good ham radio equipment, and, a lot of this stuff works.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at bits and pieces of my shack. I have one of those big power meters for UHF, VHF. It's the MFJ Giant VHF, UHF, SWR watt meter that sits on top of my LP500 to tell me how much output my 7100 is going out on FM radio. So I have a piece of MFJ equipment here in the shack.
And it's really a shame with their Meritron, how it got their act together with the Linears. Was even though I think two products are, out that complicated here in that business, but, maybe I don't know. They had a following. They were selling them. They were selling them. They were, oh, well.
Yes, indeed. It was a classic design. It was kind of relatively easy to manufacture, a little on the difficult side to screw it up, and there was a demand, and they kept the price point relatively low, so when people looked at some solid state linear amplifiers, they turned the page and looked up the MFJ models. Anyway, that's loads of fun reminiscing. I wish Martin well. 80 years old, God bless him, and we'll see what the future holds. Again, my guess would be a tendency for a couple of these company fragments to be bought up by, weekend businessmen type for a time. Whether it'll be successful or not, that's another thing we'll see. I doubt anyone will swoop in and kind of take over the whole place. Because, again, there's no guy like Martin. Anyway, thanks for another interesting topic. Wesley, you have something for tonight? Wesley, didn't hear a word. Not a word. If you listen, still haven't been able to hear a word. I don't know what to tell you.
He's got no audio. He's not getting stepped on.
Well, that's possible, but in the past, people have been just putting an empty, unmodulated carrier over him and blanketing him. So it's possible that his microphone is faulty or his radio is faulty, but it's also possible that someone's just covering them up with an empty carrier.
Boy, I hear his voice way down in the noise when he transmits.
Yeah, I kind of hear bits and pieces of that. Sometimes there's a little bit of a hum that obscures them entirely, and other times it's like someone's whispering from across the house. So, you know, either there's some problem with his transceiver. I tend to think it's more like another signal with a unmodulated carrier that's just kind of blanketing and covering him and silencing him for the most part.
Yeah, I wonder if you can hear me now.
Yes, I hear you right now, this last sentence that you said.
Okay, we'll see. So it looks like for me that somebody's covering me. He found a way to cover me and my signal. I'm gonna stop in the middle of the phrases, make sure that you're getting me. Okay. So I said, DC. Since the transmission line road is longer than 300 miles, DC is a better option because AC lines have more losses than DC for bulk power transfer. So the high voltage DC, it looks like it's better. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know. I've seen the videos you showed me. You know, I tend to have my doubts. These are guys who are promoting one method over another. So how legitimate their information is, I have no clue. There was one where it mentioned that it's a more significant loss if they're underground. But most high-power utility electrical cables, transmission lines, are done overground. So I don't think it's quite the same under both circumstances. So for situations that want to have long length power cables, possibly. But it might be different if they're over, elevated transmission lines. I mean, I understand that there are projects that are using high-voltage DC, but there's still a lot of high-voltage AC. I would assume that they have good reason.
Okay, so one of the examples from Wikipedia. The high-voltage DC link uses voltage between 100 kilovolts and 800 kilovolts. The 1,100 kilovolts link of China was completed in 2019 over the distance 3,300 kilometers, which is 2,100 miles, with power capacity 2 gigawatts. With this dimension, intercontinental connection become possible, which could help the deal with fluctuation of wind power and photovoltaic. How do you comment that?
Okay, but again, this would be far better if there were, one guy who was a specialist in direct high voltage direct current and another one in high voltage alternating current. Commercial and business are all wired to take alternating current. The cost of modifying infrastructure to deal with direct current, I'm not even sure exactly how you step down the voltage with direct current unless ultimately, you're supplying alternating current at the load site. I don't know, because most of these presentations that you sent me were simply talking about the transmission line over distances. So it might be a wonderful technology, but it's kind of probably at best an intermediary one, because everyone likes alternating current that can be stepped up and stepped down and works with motors and everything that we already have built into the infrastructure the last 120 years?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. The only thing is that what I see is that the cost of the short distances is too big comparing to the losses. And if you have a longer distance than 300 kilometers, which would be 200 miles, let's say, 200 miles, then, when we're looking at the losses in the conductor, then it looks like it's more efficient. Let me drop. Okay, so now we have Sweden and Germany that have it. In 1951, Soviet Union Between Moscow and Kashira, that was 100 kilovolts, 20 megawatts power, and Sweden, Gotland, to Mainland in 1954, and we have a Porto Velho in the state of Ronja in Sao Paulo area with a length of 2,500 kilometers, which is 1,600 miles. So it looks like it is pretty much used. But
okay, yeah, there's a lot of things that are used. I don't know what percentage of energy transmission is using high voltage DC versus AC. I would assume a very small percentage for specific situations, especially when you're handling some kind of power generation where the generators are inherently DC output sources. And, rather than convert them to AC and put them on a transmission line, you have their own separate DC transmission line. But none of the stories that you sent me seem to indicate that there's a power generating source that tends to produce AC currents that get converted to DC and then run through the transmission line. They all seem to start off as DC energy sources to begin with.
Yeah, but the DC has to be transferred into the AC, and then the AC would be delivered to the customers. But when I'm looking at Wikipedia for high voltage transmission at DC, I see hundreds of those links, mostly used in undersea or under bay areas. So that's between the Italy and their islands, between British Empire, Britain and Scotland, and plenty of others. There are plenty of it in the Baltic Sea. So it looks like it is mostly used in Europe. You just go to the Wikipedia high voltage direct current. Let me drop. Okay, the next one. I go to send. The next one is Dancing T-Handle. Did you see the video, Dancing T-Handle at 0G Space Report? Back to you.
AC2GS. Yes, Wesley. I've seen those videos for years now. They're quite interesting. I challenge you to explain it to the people listening without an actual video to supply. And I think Paul felt the sort of the same way. It's not very easy to explain the inversion of the rotation of T-valves with any assurance.
Maybe Paul would be able to take a stand on it.
Hi, Wes. Let me see if I have it. Yeah, well, I like the video very well, and his explanations going to the tennis racket and this and that. And anyone that's listening, imagine having a thing. It's a T handle in this case, and they had it on the International Space Station. And it could have been anything, but it's anything that's shaped in a form of a T. The axial part would be the straight piece, and then the handle, you have a regular T. The astronauts would spin it, and, in place. He had it on a rod. He would spin it in place, and then, it would back off the rod. The second was in floating in space, it would be spinning, and then all of a sudden it would just reverse directions. The part that was facing forward on the axial part, now 180 degrees the other way. And then a couple of seconds later, the same thing happens. It's reversing back and forth. So, yeah, very well done. It makes me think of when I was young, I was pretty good with the trampoline. We had a trampoline. And, if you do a C-drop, you come down and you do a C-drop with your legs, you're in the shape of an L. You hit that, and when you come up, if you straighten out real quick, and as you're up in the air, automatically turn you 180 degrees the other way. So I was wondering if that had something to do with it. That came to mind. Anyway, back to you, Wes.
Okay, this is being known as Gini Bekov effect. It happened in 1985 first in the Soviet cosmonaut. So the Soviet cosmonaut had to pull the handle. He unscrewed. When he unscrewed, it started to spin. That was Vladimir Jihanbekov. Gosh. And he discovered this effect in Mir space station in 1985. Then the Chinese guy did the same a year later, and I have in the same email if it's important. Now, since we are in space, I have a question to Paul. We have the Chang 3 moon lander, which is one thing, and you can say a few words about it, but at the same time, I'm really confused, absolutely really confused, because at the same time, of course, you can mention about the Voyager, because it's like 35 years, right, of the Voyager there. But at the same time, if we're talking about the moon landing, we have a private company, a private U.S. moon lander, that is still working after breaking the leg and falling down. So that happened in February 22, 2024. But that Japanese Slim was not at that time. This guy, this moon lander was for a different time. I don't have exact day, January 19th, 2024. So, are we talking about him, moon lander, or are we talking about the two different ones that actually have similar problem? Paul.
Okay, first of all, yeah. I'm glad I left you with the pronunciation of that Russian that discovered, and they named it after him, that effect. And you know, I saw the video. They were leading up to, oh no, the whole Earth could, you know, automatically switch like that. And then of course he went deep into it and explained that that will not happen. The reason why. So. There's two different landers, one by Japan, and one is the American one by Intuitive Machines. Intuitive Machines landed and the leg kind of collapsed on one side, and the whole thing tilted to 30 degrees, and it did not make it through the lunar night, which is, you know, of course, 14 days. And they were hoping that it might. They didn't design it to do that. Let me drop it. But that's the American company. They were like hoping that it would. In the future, they will. They have another lander going at the end of this year scheduled anyway. Personally, I don't think it's going to make it until the beginning of next year. But there's a whole series of them. There's nine of them planned by Intuitive Machines. That was number one. The Slim Machine, that's built by Pan. That was a stubby-looking thing, and that kind of like tilted over too, and nose first into the soil. And I don't know. First thing that crossed my mind is, I guess they didn't have any cold solder joints. It did very good. It's come back to life now three different lunar nights. But yeah, ours did not, and Japan is still going, and each time it comes back, they get another picture or two, and so they're happy with that. Anyway, back to you.
Okay, so Voyager, you're going to be talking about in the space report. I have a few more things, not much of it. Dr. Roy, calorie-restricting aging. So you can not get older, not entirely, but at least to the some percentage of it, so you can say who you are. Not older, not much. We're talking about a word that I'm not sure if I properly pronounce it, as English is not my first language. Telomere. So the telomere is responsible for the process of oldering, and is the specialized proteins proteins at the end of linear chromosomes sequence. Anyhow, it looks like when you have a cells, ladies and gentlemen, when you have a cells, the life of the cell is also making the waste. So the less calories the cells receive, the less waste they produce. So people who were eating less or being in some sort of situation where the food was restricted were just younger. And to not get confused with all of this, Dr. Roy, please, and to actually end.
Well, I don't know what you want me to tell you. We sort of saw this about 3 weeks ago when you pointed out that there were mouse studies that if you starve mouse, their median life expectancy gets longer. And I said, that's great. So any of you mice out there, don't eat too much. You know, there's all kinds of stress factors that affect longevity. I don't think you can extrapolate that successfully. Telomeres are interesting things. They are objects that are situated on the ends of chromosomes and facilitate the reproduction of the cell. So, you know, cell lines are a series of times that stem cells will reproduce to form new cells, and telomeres kind of get reduced with each cell division until you run out of lives and your telomeres run out and you have cell senescence. The cells can no longer reproduce, and that can lead to death, organ failure, and other such. But life is much more complicated than. And there are other things that affect telomeres. If you go to a hyperbaric chamber, they've done some studies that suggest that you can kind of regenerate telomeres. Whether that correlates with increased life expectancy, no one has a clue. So all these things are vaguely interesting artifacts that haven't really been proven yet to be consequential.
Okay, thank you very much for that. The next one, bioengineer Mirel Camariza. She invented the paint. She's a bioengineer and she's a professor of UCLA and in San Diego. And that was about tuberculosis. So she found a very simple test because there was the procedure that actually was very difficult. And we have a quite significant amount of people with tuberculosis. So she developed the paint, some sort of paint that allows to fight tuberculosis very easily. And that is that she has the doctoral at Stanford University in 2010. And so I don't believe that there is much comment on it. I can go to another one if you want.
I'm not particularly familiar with what you're talking about, but I think there's a language problem. I think when you say pet, you probably mean stain.
That is correct. The only thing is that that stain is called paint. So, in other words, in the material that I saw, the stain was called paint. That's why I use the word paint. Back to you.
Okay, again, I'm unfamiliar, but in a lot of microbiology, you know, these so-called gram-positive, gram-negatives use a gram stain. And there's a lot of different staining materials that bring out certain organisms. So I'm thinking that what it really meant is she developed a microbiological stain that kind of emphasizes tuberculosis bacilli.
Yeah, I have a whole material. It's called Newham UCLA. It says bioengineer Mirel Camariza. And it says Camariza has already developed potential point-of-care diagnostic tests for tuberculosis. Tuberculosis was second deadliest infectious disease behind COVID-19. And in 2010, a doctoral from Stanford University and whatsoever, as a teenager, she immigrated to U.S. from Burundi, and that's it. So more of the material is not important, just the fact that we have somebody who has made the progress in it.
Okay, I mean, not like people can't stain for acid-fast bacilli, which is what tuberculosis is. So, you know, I mean, the TB was a big killer a long time ago. Unfortunately, it kind of creeps up on us every so often when we have communities of immunocompromised people, AIDS, and homeless people now, and you know, these things never really totally go away. But, I mean, it was a massive killer in the 1800s. You know, most of the times people called it consumption.
Okay. So I have only two topics and I'm finished. 5 minutes. So, empowering silicon with optical functions such as ability to emit light and modulate light, it could be the key to creating short distance ultra-fast optical interconnect to overcome the most formidable hurdles in scaling the speed of computing. So actually, what happened is silicon photonics, but it is UCLA again, and this is Jali Ali Lab, UCLA. They made a 1-inch by 1-inch piece of silicon that looks like the LEDs, LCD screen, and is able to perform the functions, logical functions, like normal silicon dust. So if we talk about 0 and 1, which is the base in the transistor switch for the computer, for the computing, that is being done right now with fiber optics. So we're looking at the approach that optical signal is replacing the electrical signal in the structure. Back to you.
Okay. They've been working on optical logic circuits for at least 25 years. You know, maybe in 25 more years they'll have something practical to bring out or revolutionize the field. But, you know, it's been an ongoing research project. It hasn't really produced anything fundamentally useful that changes technology along those lines, but all power to them.
I hope so, too. And the last thing, dogs. In March of 22, journal Current Biology, what they say is nothing new, but they say the dogs generally also know that what certain words stands for. So the experiment was provided to make sure that the brain activity of the dogs suggests they activate matching mental representation in their minds, not only just sound by itself that repeated makes the function to sound like a comment. And they found that dogs and other mammals could have a quite significant brain function similar to the human being. So the human animal is not much different than other animals belonging to the group mammals. Back to you.
A2GS. Well, I'm kind of dubious. It's very difficult to look in on people's on brains. You know, I've mentioned it before, I'll mention it. Just because we call a color a color red doesn't mean that I see red the same way you see red, because there's no way of looking into your brain and figuring out what the hell you're perceiving. So these perceptions are very difficult to discern and understand, and we're completely inept at it. So to simply say that a dog's cognitive function is similar to ours, kind of is dubious to me, because we don't know how our cognitive function, so how you compare it to another animal, another mammal, is beyond me. A lot of times people make sloppy conclusions based on next to nothing. So I went to see their work to